Hello and welcome to the Impactful Ninja Show. I'm your host, Dennis Kamprad, and today we're joined by Ali Cox from Noble West. Ali, welcome.
Thank you, Dennis. Thanks for having me, and it's nice to be here.
Nice having you as well. It's my pleasure. Now, before we get into your journey and your story, give us a brief overview. What is Noble West?
Sure. Well, Noble West is an advertising and marketing agency, but the truth is, I think what we've emerged as is sort of a business strategist, and we are a specialty shop. So A lot of businesses come to us when they have made incredible investments in ag technology or in ESG supply chain requirements or major on-farm investments to be more sustainable or whatnot. And so those clients come to us because they need a bigger ROI for the foods that they are producing and processing because they're doing it with such a high integrity. So they come to us to say, hey, help us tell our story a little better so that we can actually command a better price point compared to maybe our neighbors or our farmer down the street that is doing like kind of not the bare minimum. And so we want to try to help those clients differentiate and get paid more from their buyers.
That already sounds like an exciting journey going a little bit more from just ad towards strategy as well. But before we're going into that, let's rewind. Give us a brief overview. What's your background? What did you do before Noble West?
Oh, sure. I mean, I love to talk about myself, don't most CEOs. I am a fifth generation farmer. So farming is in my background, both on my maternal and paternal side. I grew up in a family that has five generations of experience in row crop farming, pre-irrigation farming, raising beef cattle, produce. My family's the first family to start commercializing melons in California. That was over 100 years ago. So we have a deep history in that. And I have been in the marketing industry for, I hate to say it out loud, but 25 years. And I started in entertainment and fashion and have emerged into my true passion, which is agriculture and food ingredient marketing. And quite frankly, sustainability and technology marketing now. And I'm a wife, I'm a mom, and I'm a farmer's wife. And so we are eat, breathe, and live agriculture. And I personally believe that we respect our traditions and we respect our history, but what got us here is not going to get us there. And so now we are at a very critical point, especially, I would say, here in California. I can speak really, you know, astutely toward too, is that it is so expensive to grow food and there is so much legislation and it is a very complicated time to be a farmer. So more than ever, we need to make sure that consumers understand the value of the food that is grown here in California, the 400 specialty crops. We need to make sure consumers know that a berry grown in California versus somewhere in South America, likely, or Mexico, they can expect a different quality. So that is part of my, you know, impact that I am looking to leave, is really educating consumers about what it takes to grow food and where food should be sourced from, and then also farmers understanding more about consumer insights and their preferences.
Nice. I love it that you can really kind of feel your passion coming through for the topic as well.
Thank you. Good. I hope so, because we're, you know, what, 7,000 miles away from each other? I hope so, because I do care so much about the entire food ecosystem. Yeah.
Can you still remember, like, just going like one step back, or basically toward the beginning, when you started in marketing, when you started like working with the fashion industry, can you remember what like this like concrete like challenge for you to figure out, like, well, it's good work, but something might be missing? Were you trying to go back to your roots, trying to go back onto the path where you're on now?
Yeah, I mean, I can go back to being the director of marketing for Fashion Week in New York. That's not a problem. But frankly, my first marketing job was in elementary school when I was selling melons at the melon stand. So I remember like wanting to close those deals. So as like a 7 and 8 year old working the melon, it was called the secondhand melon. So it was the melons that were too ripe to ship. We would sell locally, like in a farm stand. And I just took it as such. I mean, I counted the money. I figured out what made more money. I figured out how, you know, I would go greet people at their cars, for example, and I would walk them to the farm. I would see them on the road and they would park and I would run out there. I would walk to them and tell them about our family story and tell them about the melons and what's really mm-hmm. fresh right now. And I would literally do everything I could to send home like boxes and boxes of melons in the trunk of their car. I would carry the boxes and put them, I would rearrange whatever was in the backseat of their car to put more melons in that car because I just cared so much about mm-hmm. the story and the message of what it took to grow it and why they are going to go and make all their friends happy and their neighbors happy by handing out melons. And the price was great. So, I mean, this started 40 mm-hmm. years ago and now I can't stop. And my goals just continue to get loftier. So I would say that was really the start of me marketing agriculture was as a child at that secondhand melon stand at Turlock Fruit Company.
Mm-hmm. Was that also the story or the journey where you shifted away from fashion back to agriculture again?
Oh, you know, well, I left out, you asked me my background. I left out a chapter. I'm an Olympic rower. So I spent 15 years on the East Coast of the United States rowing and competing in World Cups and World Championships and Olympics. So when I was on the East Coast, I decided to move to New York and try my hand at like big advertising and marketing because I was a marketing major in college and I had internships when I lived in San Diego because I went to University of San Diego. And so that I got into sports marketing and fashion marketing when I lived in New York. And it was about 12 years ago that I just said, you know, I want to go back to my roots. I know what I care about. And quite frankly, the agriculture industry needs me a heck of a lot more than the fashion industry does. So I need to go back to where my passions lie.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So after the realization that the agriculture industry needs you much more, what was the concrete first steps for you to actually get started with Noble West? Was it kind of a journey that unfolded over some kind of time, or was that like a concrete, like, let's do it now moment?
Well, it's always a journey, I think, frankly. And if anybody here listening to this podcast runs their own small business, they know it's a journey also, right? Every single day is some sort. Sometimes it's beautiful and sometimes it's a hot mess, but you know what? It is what it is. So I started my business in 2007 and it was called AC&C Marketing. I worked at several large multinational publicly traded at PR and advertising companies in New York City. And then it sort of evolved and we rebranded to Noble West 2 years ago. So the Noble West brand is new, although I would argue it's been in my heart for the last like 45 years. It's the brand that makes the most sense for me as CEO. And I think for our team as well, but it was really in 2011. I thought, you know, I got to get back to my roots. I really need to go make an impact and I need to be where my passions lie so that I can do the most good in the world.
How was that feeling for you in 2011 when you then really made the transition? And how did the first steps go for you there?
Well, they were rocky, Dennis.
I could see you there.
Yeah, they were rocky. They were tough. But the truth is, like in our industry, and I think probably most folks who are also in the service industry, and I know that you've had some wonderful consultants on the podcast and whatnot, good work begets more good work. So if you do good work and you do have great customer service and you provide impact for your clients, like one project, one phenomenal project can lead to 2 to 3 to 4. And because our clients travel in the same circles. And so there's word of mouth that happens. But then there's also, you know, this thing called the internet where like good work, like it pollinates. And as soon as you start applying for awards and you start putting your work out on LinkedIn and you start like paying attention to the algorithms and you have a website that is really highly functioning. And also it kind of snowballs. And that is what happened. So one great project that I did, you know, on my own, because at that point it was just me. I was a freelancer and starting out and I had an assistant and, you know, that I kind of broke my back on a couple early projects. And then, but it gave me enough of a story that when I would get my foot in the next potential client or customer's office, I could use that as my background. So it's always building.
Mm-hmm. Nice. It sounds like really kind of the snowball that you mentioned before. Like you do great work, you do great customer service, your clients are happy. There's some word of mouth and let's keep going.
Yeah. And here's the thing. I think we all know this. Like people like to work with people they like to work, like to be around.
Yes.
So like if you have a nice personality, chances are like you're going to get a nice referral. And if you follow through and you're smart and you do what you say you're going to do and you over deliver in many cases, your business is going to grow. And, mm-hmm. but that's not without challenge, because every business yeah. is just fraught with challenge, but
that's a nice point. That's a nice yeah. point to get into later on as well, into the challenges. But before we go into the challenges, let's go into your passion as well. So you kind of were able to marry your two passions, one with the marketing, but then the other one also to help agriculture, let's say, to become more sustainable, to bring more visibility to better agricultural practices. What were some of your favorite projects how you were able to help your clients in this regard?
They're all different, but sort of related. We do a lot of work in the California rice industry, mm-hmm. which is very, very fulfilling for me. So the rice industry in California is in the Sacramento Valley, the northern part of California. It's very arid. There's also very wet winters. And there's a big migrant bird population that goes through there. It's just the perfect place to grow rice, right? Mm-hmm. And it's short and medium grain rice. And they're grown in paddies, just like you see in the south part of, in Asia or the southern part of the United States. And there are about 700,000 acres planted. And working within this industry has been really fulfilling. We've worked on sprouted projects. We've worked on sake projects. We have worked on manufacturing projects, meaning that rice that is milled is then manufactured to a puff or a flour or a panko, basically any sort of gluten-free option. And that has been incredibly rewarding because rice farmers have had a very tough challenge during the California droughts. From a legislative point of view, they have been cut off water, even up to 100% in some years. So just how rice works in California is amazing. So I always say, what does this mean for consumers? This means to consumers, your sushi is going to be more expensive because, we even export short grain rice, sushi rice to Japan because they don't even have enough acreage to serve their needs. So sushi will be more expensive because of the rice, not even necessarily the fish, which is mm-hmm. crazy because from a value proposition, we know the fish is probably more valuable mm-hmm. from supply. So that's been fascinating. We're working on an upcycling fruit project, which has mm-hmm. been very, very fulfilling. I know you cover upcycling on this podcast. I love yes. you. Gary Jeweler on. Shout out to Gary, a great innovative guy from Michigan. We're working on an amazing beverage project with an organic beverage juice that is creating a foundation and a nonprofit to support the transition from conventional produce to organic produce to shore up supply chain opportunities for organic fruit growers in the United States. That's been great. So again, it's really just, it's amazing. And honestly, I should just say, anytime we get to support a client, launch a new brand or launch a new initiative or launch a new, a rebrand, we're working on a very, very, I'll call it just heady rebrand right now that mm-hmm. with many stakeholders who speak different languages. So it is that is something that's been really fulfilling. But again, these are business challenges. I don't think of them as creative challenges necessarily mm-hmm. or advertising or marketing challenges. They are business challenges that require incredible artistic and creative and strategic minds. So it's just really exciting to be part of this, frankly.
Nice. It sounds also super exciting from the kind of diverse range of projects that you shared, just with these two projects, how they sound so differently.
Yeah. We work with right now, about 17 different commodity types. Mm-hmm. So from produce to rice, different types of produce, cherries, onions, a ton in walnuts, a ton in almonds. I've worked in pecans. We've worked in cranberries. Cantaloupes, you name it. And it's something that is just I just feel very proud to lead a team of strategists and creatives who clients can rely on to help them as partners. It's just one of the most, it is the most satisfying part of my entire career.
Nice.
Which as you mm-hmm. politely pointed out, has been going on for about 25 years. So.
Yeah. And also in that time, we already hinted at it. There was also some challenge along the way. You mentioned some kind of creative challenges, some business challenges. Walk us through maybe one or two of those. What was the biggest challenge and what was your learnings out of these?
Well, I always say you're always going to have pots boiling on the stove and you're always tending the boil, right? And some are exploding. And so it's just about managing that. And so I always think everything's simmering and then something's always, I always say one department mm-hmm. within the company probably has to be rebuilt at any given day. I don't know what to say. It is what it is. And I think that's why agencies are an amazing collective. So there's that. But a challenge is that, this is kind of under the weeds. if you have any advertising folks listening, they'll understand, is resource management. So I need to carry enough resources at this company that if the phone rings and there's an amazing appropriate opportunity, like right now we are responding to a humongous RFP that could create incredible change for a commodity within California that is struggling immensely, struggling so much that my own family has pulled out 80 acres of trees of this type. There are trees getting pulled out because it is struggling so deeply. Mm-hmm. We are responding to a humongous RFP that if we win it, I'm going to be able to create so much good for my neighbors and my friends and my family. And it's so deep. So like, I would say that's like an example of what I kind of get to work mm-hmm. on every day, which is why I'm so fired up about it. But it's really resource management. So we need to be able to respond to the RFPs that we care about, like the one I just mentioned. We also need to be able to service our current clients who we appreciate and value tremendously, but then also not carry too much overhead that people aren't utilized properly. So the resource management is like the hardest part of scaling. And I'm mm-hmm. probably not unique in saying that, right? Yeah. It's like farmers, they, and right now there's a huge trend in using labor contractors. So like a lot of farmers aren't carrying as many full-time or even permanent seasonal employees because they just don't know if they're going to need them month to month. And if they're more harvest specialists or if they're great in the wintertime, like they don't know that. And so that's why there's a trend in labor contractors. And I would argue like, that's just, I think that we have to get creative with mm-hmm. resourcing because frankly, like payroll's, you know, 95% of my expenses at this company. Yeah.
No, I feel you with this. Though our model is quite different than, let's say, an agency model, but still, yeah.
Yeah, it's business. How do you keep people busy, but not so busy that they're burned out, right? That's like the number one. That is, we could turn this into like a leadership podcast, like talking about that. Like, how do you keep people busy and stimulated, but not mm-hmm. burned out, but also like really engaged, and so they can see upward mobility? It's a challenge.
Yeah.
That's my challenge.
And I can imagine based on the type of work you're doing, you also have like a super select or a special group of people you're working with. Where I'm coming from, that's what I've heard basically from every single person I interviewed on the podcast and from ourselves as well. What we're looking mm-hmm. into is people first and foremost who are passionate for what we are doing. This is the number one criteria and everything else comes afterwards. And it sounds like it might be exactly the same for you.
Well, you know, I interview people differently now than I ever did. And admittedly, when somebody, a candidate is in the interview pipeline, by the time they get to me, it's already been vetted that they're capable to do the job. So like they can already do whatever the job description requirements are. So for me, it's really more culture and kind of fit, more of a fitness check, maybe, I guess. I don't know. But like some first questions I ask are like, tell me about your favorite dinner you ever ate. Or tell me about like, what's the best tomato you ever had and where was it from? And if they don't care and they're stumbling on that answer, they really will not like working here. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
Same with client selection. If we get a lead from a client or we're talking to a potential client and say in their food product, there's 4 or 5 ingredients, like we're probably the, our sweet spot as an agency is no more than 3 ingredients because we need to tell the ag story. So that's just like a sweet spot. But if they don't like, if say it's like a, let's say it's like a cookie or like a bar or a smoothie or something, and like they don't know where the sugar came from, like one of the key ingredients, and they're like, oh, it just came off the Sysco truck. I'm like, you're going to hate working with us because that sugar, your sugar partner, whomever this is such a huge, is it, how was the cane grown? How was it harvested? Where did they process it? Why are you buying this sugar versus that sugar? I mean, how does this impact the whole story? It matters. So that's, maybe that's a little bit of a rabbit hole, but I think that it's just about being intentional, and intentional leads to being impactful.
Yeah. No, it's also great that you mentioned like being intentional about the client selection and really ensuring that they know where all their resources, they know where all the ingredients come from.
Totally.
Now let's have a look into the future a little bit. For Noble West, you said just a recent rebranding. What is the outlook? What are you imagining there in the next couple of years when it comes to kind of the impact that you want to have?
Yeah, I think that the Noble West offering is going to continue to get more and more narrow. Mm-hmm. So we will probably do more work and take on more projects and work with clients with more similarities. Like, so that way we really, really, really become an expert. Cause now we do work across sustainability, ag tech, food tech, growers. I mean, we do that now And I have to say, 10 years ago, when I said, I'm going to sunset every client that is not in ag, it felt very narrow and scary to most people that worked with me at the time. And frankly, they all quit within 6 months because it was too scary for them. They didn't think it was possible. And that's all well and good. But what I do think is that even though this feels like a specialty niche shop, I think we're going to get more niche. Mm-hmm. I think all of our work is going to somehow touch sustainability. And the reason why is not because I think it's like the right thing to do or it feels good or whatnot. It's because farmers are becoming sustainability experts. Whether they know how to say those words or they like those words, it's the truth. And so wherever farmers and brands that care about deeply about their sourcing are, like, that's where we're going to be.
Plus, to add on, it also is the right thing to do. So that makes it even better.
Well, I think it's the right thing for everybody. I think it's the right thing for the climate. I think it's the right thing for the farmers, because that means that they would actually get a bigger ROI for growing like more high quality food. It also means that there's education with consumers about how to source their food and how to buy food that is aligned with their ethos. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's like a deeper story.
Yep.
Which also requires a lot more critical thinking on what is allowed to be imported into the country.
Also thinking about from your customer or client's perspective, you mentioned that for the future, you're aiming to go a little bit narrower as well and trying to expand a little bit more there. Let's just assume some potential customers are listening at the moment. Who would be your ideal customer and how should they reach out to you?
Well, they should be very fun. they should be really fun and love new ideas. The potential perfect customer for us is somehow tied to the agriculture industry or food or the food ingredient industry. So either they are a food processor, they are a food brand that cares deeply about getting a return for high impact sourcing. They are a farming entity that grows food and sells it and wants to get paid more for their farming efforts. They might be a client that has ESG goals, but don't know how to articulate them. They also might not know how to articulate all the good things they're already doing. There's a lot of that. I would say, Dennis, that's really a big thing, is a lot of companies, and I don't want to sound too Pollyanna about this, I really don't, but there are a lot, especially, I'm just going to speak to California, and because it's so articulate, there, the requirements to grow and process food in the state of California are so rigorous that by default, if you're running your business in a compliant method, this isn't even like extra, extra, extra with extra robots and extra solar and whatnot, because there are so many processing plants that are already required to be net neutral. So they are using renewable energy. They are recycling all of their water. This is already happening. And if you don't actually talk about it and package your operation up with a bow, your clients, which are like brands that are buying ingredients, can't roll that into their ESG reporting. And they can't roll it into their ESG reporting. Their leadership is off like talking about all these aspirant things that they want to do to like hit ESG goals or mandates by their shareholders. And they're already doing it. And so if there's anybody listening who has that challenge, please call me.
Nice. We'll put all your information, including a link to your website as well, into the show notes and on screen now.
Awesome.
With that in mind, let's take a little transition. Since you started working with your own agency, since you started focusing more on sustainability in the agricultural industry, how would you say has that impacted your own life? Have you felt any changes based on, for example, how you're shopping for ingredients or for food, or is there anything else that has impacted it?
Mm-hmm. Sure. You know, of course, I have a little bit of a leg up because I grew up only really eating produce that was grown on our farm or around our farm or from our farming neighbors. And of course, living where I live in the Central Valley, we have amazing, the farmers markets are just like blow your mind, extraordinary produce, right? The best, like the best grown on the best soil. They're amazing. So I have that bias, but I would say like feeding my own family, I read the back of the, I don't buy anything without reading the back of the label. I always check where it was originated. And I think most women who are feeding, you know, sorry guys, but like 90% of all consumer purchases in the home are made by women. So that are basically within the age of like 26 and like 45 years old. So I'm like right in there. But like, I read the back of the label. I look for the story. I typically, if it's a new brand, I go to their Instagram or I go to their website or I go to their Pinterest. So I would say just like, I do that due diligence, not only because I care about it, but it's interesting. And also like, if I'm price comparing, like I'm really want to know what the story is, because there are some, you know, there's some sort of, and I don't want to call them splurges, but I would call them like investment purchases that I just think make so much more sense.
Nice. And with this in mind, let's already go into our final question. If you had to share one tip with our audience on how we could become more impactful, what would your number one tip be for us?
My number one tip would be to stop eating food that is not grown regionally. Let me like clarify a bit. Produce. Stop eating produce that is not grown regionally, that is temperature dependent, because that is doing the most harm. That's where organic food that is not grown within like 500 miles of wherever you're consuming it, it cannot arrive organically. It arrives with ethylene. You have to put ethylene on a truck in the, they have to pipe the container with ethylene in order to keep it so it ripens just right on time, right when you want it. And so I would say your most impactful, and also eating seasonally for a lot of us, like eating seasonally is super critical. Like in most parts of the world, like a salad doesn't make sense. Now there's this awesome exception, which is called hydroponic farming. And hydroponic farming is happening all over the world. And it's a huge investment that a lot of, it's been funded by the venture capitalists. It's innovating. So, you know, there are hydroponic farms, you know, surrounding Calgary and, you know, surrounding all these like super snowy cold places in the winter. That is an amazing option. That's biodiverse. There's like nutritional. It's also regional. There's like barely any chemicals that are used, if any. It's grown in a temperature controlled environment. So I would just sort of say, be impactful about where your produce is coming from.
Mm-hmm. No, thanks. Thanks so much. I love that tip. I love eating seasonal as well, and always the fresh produce from here. So that fully resonates in a good sense as well, which is always nice. Well, thanks. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks so much for all the good work you're doing, Ali.
Thank you for having me on, Dennis.
My pleasure. And to everyone else, thanks so much for joining us as well, and stay impactful.